Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Your granny had one, maybe your mother had one, and you better believe Irish Country Living has one. Welcome to The Good Room. I'm your host, Janine Kennedy, and in this podcast, I'll be inviting some really interesting people to The Good Room to hear different perspectives and approaches to our rapidly changing environment. Join me and my guests for a cuppa and some fancy biscuits while we attempt to solve the world's big problems. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Good Room. In this podcast, we're looking at the issues which affect rural Ireland and the rest of the world from a gastronomic, political, and agricultural perspective. Each month, I'll speak with experts in their fields, including some of Ireland and the world's best culinary minds. You can find the written content from these interviews in Irish Country Living, which you'll find inside the Irish Farmers Journal each Thursday on your local newsstand. Now, with Easter fast approaching, chocolate seems to be on everyone's mind. But how much do we actually know about chocolate and how it's grown, processed, and shipped? How does it become the bar of creamy deliciousness we all know and love? In actuality, cocoa production is fraught with human rights, labor, and environmental problems, and the same can be said for many other global commodity ingredients. Is it fair to blame the countries producing these ingredients for these problems? Maybe on a very simplistic level, they can share a bit of the blame, but most of these issues stem from the demand from us, wealthier Western nations who just really love a good old Easter egg. In this month's episode of The Good Room, I want to take a closer look at the influence Western countries have had, and continue to have, on the problems other parts of the world face when it comes to food production and agriculture. How have our taste buds, demand for certain ingredients, and Europe's deep history of colonization affected food production as we see it today? When I was a little girl, our local church sponsored a family from Guatemala who were fleeing civil war. The family consisted of a mother and her very young son. I suppose he would be around the same age as myself. They stayed in our community for a while and now live in another part of Canada. I think the mother remarried and had another child. They're safe and secure. But I don't know if they could ever really overcome the reasons they had to flee to Canada in the first place. By the time this mother and her son came to our community, Guatemala had been engaged in a bloody civil war for decades. The war was between the poorer indigenous population and those who descended from European colonizers. This might be oversimplifying it, but that's basically what it was. These people owned much of the land, worked closely with large Western corporations like the United Fruit Company, and financially controlled the laborers who worked their land. Yes, food and agriculture had a major role to play in this war. This was the first time I, a privileged, safe, and secure white child, came face to face with the serious problems surrounding food commodification, even though at the time I obviously didn't realize it. It wasn't until I was in university studying Latin American politics that I really truly realized why this family had come to our community. They were long gone and living new lives by the time the realization struck, and I was an emotional wreck, finally realizing all they went through and for what reasons, mainly so wealthy nations like Canada and the US could eat as many bananas as we wanted. Again, that's kind of oversimplifying everything, but that was basically it. In the early 1950s, the United States backed a military coup in the country to basically eradicate the leftist governments which had been more recently elected by the people. During the 80s, when I was born, the Guatemalan government was almost entirely run by the military, and they were brutally killing anyone associated with the resistance. Entire villages were massacred. The woman's husband was a solicitor and an intellectual, so a real enemy of the state. He was killed, and the mother and child barely escaped with their lives, all for the supreme control over land use and food commodities. Guatemala is kind of an extreme example of how demand for certain foods can lead to serious human rights violations, including genocide and war crimes. But in reality, and in modern day times, this type of demand for ingredients is still driving human rights, societal, political, and environmental problems. I worked my way through university, and one of my jobs was a coffee barista. I worked for the first fair trade coffee company in Canada, and through this job, I learned a great deal about the commodification of food and its true cost. Now, fair trade isn't the be-all end-all I thought it was back then. We know there are problems. A scholarly paper by Anne Mook and Christine Overdevest, for example, says that when it comes to fair trade, farmers are generally happy with the social justice benefits like gender empowerment and the reduction of child labor, while they're less satisfied with the market or the effect it's had on environmental sustainability. So there are definitely things to address within fair trade. However, as one of my interviewees, Allison Roberts, says, fair trade works well in specific areas for specific things. In her opinion, one of the areas in which it is working as intended is in West African cocoa production. In this month's podcast, I'm exploring some of the ingredients we've commodified over the years and the effect this has had on local populations. Also, since it's Easter, we're looking at cocoa production and how one of our favorite ingredients has been the cause of a lot of environmental and societal strife in cocoa-producing countries. While it's difficult as a consumer to avoid these ingredients, I'm sure we can all agree that by talking about these problems and normalizing the conversation, we can in some small way lead to change. I'm not strictly religious, but I can at least attest to the good my local church and community provided for one small family in the 1980s. Of all the Irish food podcasts out there, the one I love most is Spice Bags. Brought to you by three really insightful, fun, and knowledgeable women, it's no surprise Spice Bags won the inaugural Irish Food Writing Award for Best Food Podcast in November of last year. Dee Laffin, Blanca Valencia, and Mei Chin all come from different places and have different backgrounds and cultures. However, they all have a deep love and passion for great food, and what makes their podcast unique is their unique perspectives. I knew if I wanted to talk food commodification, these three women were going to provide a lot of interesting food for thought. Excuse that terrible pun. I'm so sorry. I'm a huge fan of Spice Bags. We'll start with that. And my particular favorite episode, I think, was your food and literature episode. Oh, yeah. I absolutely love that. It's, you know, remember reading Stephen King growing up and being like, ooh, the way he talks about food is so visceral and weird. But it kind of makes me also crave whatever writing about. Yeah. So when you guys were all talking about that kind of stuff, I was like, yeah, absolutely, because you wouldn't think about it unless someone brings up the conversation. And I guess that's what we're doing today, is we're kind of bringing up, kind of starting and normalizing the conversation around food commodification, our demand for it in the West, and the effect that it has on local populations in food producing countries of commodities. So I guess we're looking at things like bananas, we're looking at nuts, we're looking at seafood. In particular, I guess with my article that's coming out this week, it's about cocoa and chocolate. So we're going to touch on that as well. But anyway, but we're looking at specific ingredients. I suppose each of you kind of chose an ingredient yourself, and I think we'll start with you, May, because you're coming from a perspective, and I suppose Blanca, you are as well. I am as well. We're all coming from different countries. Dee is the only native Irish person here. Mm-hmm. But we all come from places where there are examples of this kind of how commodification has kind of affected
us or our culture. And so you wanted to focus on shrimp, is that right?
Sure, or prawns.
Prawns.
Well, Dee was reminding me.
Oh,
she
yeah,
said,
sorry,
she said,
not
she
shrimp.
Said the Irish people will not know what you're talking about when you say
like, just
shrimp, honey, just like prawns. And I was like, oh, prawns. Okay, yeah, but mm-hmm. but prawns or shrimp, as I like to call it. But mm-hmm.
And, same.
And I think one of the reasons why I chose it is I'm Chinese American. My mother grew up in the South, and I was also a New England girl. So I'm kind of a shrimp prawn triple threat. Like, and so this idea of prawns being this luxury protein that's also the backbone of your diet, right? You know, so it's part of dim sum, it's part of your scrambling and your eggs, but it makes it special. And I do remember when in the supermarket you could suddenly start getting these big bags of prawns. I think they were called black tiger prawns.
Yes.
Easy peel.
Yeah.
With the intestines removed. Mm-hmm. And they were manufactured in Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided, you know, the other day I was saying, I'm just going to look up Thailand and prawns. And, you know, The Guardian did an expose in 2016 about the slave labor, specifically that was used to catch the small fish that was then used to process feed for the prawns.
Yeah.
There was still kind of dodgy stuff, I think, going on about the peeling. I know that Thailand has been looking at these practices. However, also there have been other stories about Vietnam, India. And the other question too is that, you know, there are Vietnamese entrepreneurs. So, you know, once upon a time, this guy might have had a rice paddy and that would be all that he would know. Now he is sort of engaging with aquaculture. Like he might be feeding his prawns antibiotics, but he's engaging with aquaculture. He can send his kids to university and he can, you know, and expands his horizon. So I don't know. I definitely know I don't think I'm going to eat prawns from Thailand, easy peel. For a while, but yeah. I don't know. And then the other thing too was, and I know we discussed this before, but I know that a lot of people say the solution is to up the price, but I feel as though, and I mentioned this, that, you know, doing cooking classes for a domestic violence shelter, there's some people who can't afford that. And are we then banning, because we feel guilty, are we then banning people? And I know, for instance, prawns would be such, you know, like prawns. Again, we bought the big bags of prawns for our domestic violence shelter. And, you know, it would be blacks, it would be Hispanics, it would be Asians, it would be Indians. And it's like this just, it's such a treat, you know. And so how do we resolve that?
It's really hard, isn't it? It's that question of being, you know, a food elitist. And, you know, I'm always saying that with fine dining, for example, you know, it's got its place. But at the end of the day, you know, food should be accessible and good restaurant food should be accessible for everybody as well, you know. And it does come back to that, doesn't it?
Yeah. Or just to be able to cook.
Yeah.
Really.
But I think one thing about prawns that it surprised me how in Ireland you have Dublin Bay prawns, but people sell them to Spain.
I was going
to
say, we don't have them here.
Yeah.
They're from here.
They're delicious and they're in every fishmonger in Spain and here, like people buy from Thailand.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately the solution is that we need to learn to use the stuff that's around us. And I think that's where a lot of countries fail because they export a lot of the quality stuff.
I mean, especially when you're an island. I mean, when you're talking about seafood, I mean, it's our greatest kind of failure, I suppose, as an island. But, you know, there's that horrendous statistic that's always said, and that's 80% of the fish we eat in Ireland is imported and 80% of Irish seafood is exported. Like it's just a bonkers statistic.
It was actually my first job in a restaurant was peeling Dublin Bay prawns.
Oh yeah.
And
in Toronto.
And I
you can get them everywhere.
Also, you can serve them, like in Spain we serve it like for you to peel. And there's a big issue, like my husband hates peeling like any seafood or eating. It needs to come, and I'm like, no, it makes more sense, it's more flavorful, it cooks better. So
we
it's
have
also
that problem in Nova Scotia too with lobster.
I was going to say though that I remember when I moved here and you had beautiful gambas and you have langoustine, like the Dublin Bay prawns, but I was used to prawns as being a commodity. Sometimes I get home from work, it's 7 p.m., I want to just have something easy peel, throw it in with some garlic and some parsley, and that wasn't available, and now it is.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's the convenience factor.
And but also, like, I'm not a huge meat eater. And I never thought that I would ever have to feel guilty about eating essentially what is tasty bugs from the sea. But now I do. Like, I don't like beef. I don't really like pork that much, you know, but
it's one of those things when you start researching it, you go down the rabbit hole and you realize all of the foods that you love. And there's just something attached to all of them.
It's a human cost, I think, for me. I was going to say also the other thing that I was thinking about with my shrimp / prawn guilt. I eat a lot of dried shrimp as a Chinese.
I love dried shrimp.
Oh, dried shrimp is so delicious.
Shrimp sauce. Oh,
yeah, it's so shrimp's great. XO sauce, you know, like throwing some in my stir fry. I'm going, because I personally, and I feel like I can say this as a Chinese person, I don't think a lot of Chinese people will have, you know, too much guilt about where their dried shrimp is coming from. And so, and,
yeah, it's a pantry staple, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I, you know, but the labor chain that may have resulted in my delicious dried shrimp that, like, I will, like, pop in my mouth or sprinkle in congee or all that. Oh, it's worrying.
I mentioned in the article, but in Ireland, it wasn't that long ago where kids were pulled out of school to help during busy farming periods. You know, it, child labor, a lot of the times, even the child labor we see today, is very similar. It's a family farm, perhaps, and their kids, they simply need their children to help them on the farm.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it better or right, you know, but it is one of those things. It's separate from the child slavery or the child trafficking that you might see elsewhere. So I guess moving on to you, Blanca, you have kind of a background growing up in Central America.
And Spain. So
you have this real connection to cocoa in particular, which is what the focus of the article is this week and just in time for Easter. So what can you tell us about this commodity?
Well, what I find fascinating is obviously cocoa came in to Europe and through Spain. And what people don't realize is this is the food of the gods of the Mayas and pre-Mayan culture. And you can see it everywhere you go, in Mexico, in El Salvador, in Guatemala, like the vessels and the drawings of people picking cocoa. And obviously the Spaniards realized this is a high-end luxury product. And isn't that amazing that the products that were high-end ended up in Europe as high-end? So this was a product that was immediately brought to Europe. And it's the first in a line of, you know, products like coffee, tea, and chocolate as a drink. They were all very similar with caffeine and they kind of alter your mood. But the first big success was in Spain. You had chocolaterias everywhere. And we still have a very famous one in Madrid called San Ginés, which is from 1894. But there's a passion in Spain for liquid chocolate, which is how the pre-Columbian people drank it. But what I find fascinating, how that product, which has so much history and culture, and it was a really, and it was made in so many different permutations. It was sweet, it was with chili, it was with so many different things.
It was kind of a superfood.
It was a superfood, but it was something, you know, that was used. It wasn't something that everybody drank, and it was a special occasion thing, how it's become now this mass commoditized, unrecognizable thing that we grow in Africa, in West Africa. And we've taken this product, brought it to countries that don't have a culture of it, countries that are not always amazingly run. And then this product kind of got lost. And I love when you see Mexican chocolate or you see Latin American chocolate. But one fascinating thing that I found out recently was that William and Mary, William of Orange, were the first people to really be interested in cocoa. And they had a cocoa kitchen built in Hampton Court.
Wow.
Which was rediscovered a couple of years ago, and you can visit it now, where they had chefs come in and make cocoa for them, and they would bring it and they would have it in bed. So they were the first people, like the royalty, to adopt it and build this kitchen. Slave labor in countries that are very opaque, we're never going to be able to solve it. So we need to think, is there something that companies can do? Can they pay higher wages? But these people are using children because they're desperate. And I think it's something that we can solve as consumers by
asking the questions.
Asking and moving towards better chocolate.
Mm. And making it that kind of food of the gods once again in our kind of society.
Not every day.
There must be, and I don't know the figures on this, I don't know if you do, it must be one of the most wasted products as well. Like there must be, when you think about, I saw Easter eggs in January in supermarkets, and I hate that, you know, that marketing driving thinking, but like surely that chocolate has a shelf life that, you know, and if they're selling it in January and Easter is in April, I don't know, like whatever preservatives or whatever has gone into it to make it last that long. But then also, like, how many Easter eggs can one family, can one person consume? And I'm sure that parents throw out chocolate or try and donate it or whatever.
Definitely.
But then it also doesn't happen in my house.
Supermarkets must, I mean, I know now with the likes of Food Cloud and things like that, there are ways to donate it to charity and things, but there's, it still must be a wasted commodity. Mm. And I think that is one of the things that when you talk about commodities, and as you said, these things that were, you know, so foreign, so like, you know, different, imported to Europe, have become so mainstream, so commercial, so not luxury anymore in some ways. Like, you can still get luxury versions, but as you said, people opt for the cheaper one.
Yeah.
Cocoa, or cacao in Spanish,
cacao,
comes from Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast. It's very specific. You can't grow
cocoa in Spain. 70% of all cocoa is coming from those two countries now.
So it's very, that's why it's opaque. It's like these two countries that are, you know, not as clear, they don't have a clear supply chain, the political system is not as stable or as, it's more corrupt, so it's very hard.
Dee, you, for your particular topic of interest, you wanted to kind of bring it home a little bit and talk about the Irish context in terms of commodification and how that's affected us and our farmers.
I think it's one of those things that we always think of this, we do think of importation, but in some ways exploitation can happen on a very local level and in different forms. Irish vegetable farmers, or the Irish vegetable farm industry, is in crisis at the moment. It has been for a long time, but it's really becoming to a point now. At one point in Ireland, there was over 400 Irish vegetable farmers commercially growing and providing the demand. There are less than 100 now left in Ireland, and only recently this year, in the past couple of months, I think there's about five more have closed, like big farmers of broccoli, of cabbage, of all of these day-to-day regular vegetables that we just take for granted here. You know, you just take for granted that they grow well here, carrots, everything, potatoes. You know, we all know, I suppose potatoes has been one where the light has been shone on the importation of people realizing their potatoes are coming from Israel or somewhere like that. But, you know, so the point is that over the years, even though the cost of growing vegetables in Ireland has risen due to, you know, diesel costs, seeds, fertilizer, labor, energy, and the cost of vegetables in the supermarkets has been getting lower. We've all seen the super savers or the six for whatever, 49 cent
bag of carrots,
recession busters. And look, you know, the supermarkets think that they are trying to help consumers, and, you know, but at the end of the day, as the price is getting lower, those costs are still rising for vegetable farmers, and the difference is that the price, that increase has been put on them. It hasn't, the supermarkets haven't taken that on, and so the supermarkets are really exploiting farmers. And there's a difference of, I heard a farmer speak on Nationwide recently, a really big one in North County Dublin, who's closed, two brothers who've been doing it for like 40 years, their dad did it before them, and the farmer was so emotional, they had to stop filming and go back to him. He got so upset. He was like, this is not a decision they've taken lightly. They really don't want to do this, but they're being forced out of business. And he said, it's the difference of 15%. That's what the difference is for them to survive. It's about 10 cent on your bag of carrots or something like that. And that's what would help them survive.
There's that whole idea of bringing it back to the consumer at the end of the day. Like, you know, we say we spend, oh my God, I'm spending, Alice and I were talking about this, I'm spending 10% of my paycheck on food this month. And and she said, like, that always blows my mind. It should be 50%. That comes back to our other costs, you know, cost of living and the increases that we're seeing there as well. So
And I think the future is really grim here for Irish vegetables, Irish grown vegetables. And I know Maven, you made a comment earlier about like you can't just raise the price in some instances, but actually a lot of farmers would in this instance would say that we just actually do have to pay more for vegetables. So people are paying 49 cent, you know, or whatever, which is actually that we shouldn't even talk about that because that's just ripping. Like no one is winning there. It's just ripping people off. But for like if you're paying 120 or something now for a veg, like you need to be paying 140 is realistic, something like that. And that would really, really stabilize things for a while. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't stop what's happening, but it would definitely stabilize it. And I know people are like, oh, Irish people are just, you know, give out a lot about just everything. The price is going up on everything. So it'll seem that this is just unreasonable or something. But actually, when you look behind it, you'll realize it's not. I mean, farmers are being used to market this product. Yeah. They are being exploited.
Their faces are on the packages.
But they're not being paid for that. Mm-hmm. Like their faces are up on the walls on these big, you walk into some of the bigger supermarkets and they're up on the walls holding their veg. Yet they're not getting paid for that. Mm-hmm. Like one broccoli farmer was saying that for a 49 cent head of broccoli, like it actually costs more to produce it than the price mm-hmm. of that. Yeah. So like, it's just, you know, it just doesn't make sense for him to actually grow it.
And the funny thing is, I think like for me coming from Canada, maybe for you as well, mate, coming from the States, like I find that the hunger gap in Ireland is so much shorter than I would experience back home. Mm. We can't grow vegetables the way you guys can. Mm. I think your growing conditions are really excellent. And I know maybe compared to maybe Spain, for example, or other warmer parts of the world, you're not, but I mean, compared to a lot of places, you're able to grow for a lot of the year.
And this is one of the things is that a lot of people are saying now to try and help with, you know, greenhouse gas emissions. And they're trying to steer dairy farmers mm-hmm. or meat farmers away from that production and into vegetable growing. But actually, it's not sustainable for them. So if you want us to stop producing more less meat, then you need to and encourage farmers to go into vegetables, then it needs to be supported. An mm-hmm. ombudsman was supposed to have been set up, and the government said they were going to set it up to monitor fairness mm-hmm. Among farmers and supermarkets, but it never happened. And there was an investigation launched a little recently, but still it's just like another paper that's going to be written and put on a desk of a governing body. It's not going to do anything. So I think the thing to say to consumers, because obviously consumers are going to be the ones who lose out in the end, as well as because you're going to not have Irish vegetables. Mm-hmm. You're only going to have, you know, vegetables that are imported. And then that cost to import vegetables are going to increase in price hugely, more than the 15-20% we're talking about now. It's going to be huge to import vegetables. So, and then you're not getting nutritionally dense vegetables from your own backyard, as mm-hmm. in Virgo, you know what I mean? But whatever. So consumers just really need to kind of look at to make sure that demand is there, that they're not going for the cheaper vegetables. I know budget is difficult. We just talked mm-hmm. about that. Like you but have to you buy talk, to your budget at times. But
if you look at some recent stats, I know that we just released some last week, the consumers are willing to pay, a good portion of consumers are willing to pay a bit more.
Okay, I was going to ask, like, what is the most efficient way to sort of communicate with the consumer? Yeah. I mean, I even know myself, like, I'll go to Aldi or Lidl and be mm-hmm. like, ooh, like 49 cent mm-hmm. broccoli.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what's the best way to communicate?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard because I think the majority of Irish consumers want to support Irish. And I think mm-hmm. they're more willing to support Irish than they are to support organic, for example.
But we also don't like being ripped off.
Exactly.
And so I think that this is something that because it's in our own country, you can really, like, chocolate may not, you know, cocoa farmers supporting them may not ring home because it's not in our, you know, mm-hmm. you want to support, I suppose, local farmers as well. It's just another thing. But I think that consumers will take the cost on. Mm-hmm. The other thing is just to say there has been some success with organic farmers, mm-hmm. which is what you're talking about earlier. It's unusual that some of the organic farmers, because their supply wasn't supermarkets, it was vegetable box, it was farmers markets.
Yeah,
there's
sales.
Actually been 112% rise in their sales mm-hmm. and their profits from some of those like Beechlawn in Galway. I looked up in this radio show I listened to, they gave as an example. And he was saying, but they're also the rise of it's the same increases in producing are there.
Yes.
So that
they still use diesel and organic farms, you know, the seeds are still increasing in price. Yeah, yeah. They still have their inputs.
And also they've had to find other supply chains, you know, so they do sometimes supply to local shops, maybe not like big supermarkets, but local shops. And those shops are still having to battle with price and things like that because the shops want to offer the best price for consumers or value.
Yeah.
So I guess the solution really, from what the vegetable farmers are saying, is that the price does need to go up, or in the unlikely event that supermarkets would take on that 15-20% to help them survive.
For this month's Chef Chat, I really wanted to speak with someone who knows their chocolate inside out and backwards. For me, there's no one better than fellow Canadian Alison Roberts, owner and founder of Exploding Tree Chocolate in Clonakilty, County Cork. Alison has spent time in West Africa visiting with Fairtrade cocoa cooperatives, from whom she actually sources her cocoa. She's been working with chocolate for a long time, but more recently she made the move to bean to bar. That means she sources raw cocoa beans and makes the chocolate from scratch in her small manufacturing space in the back of her house. To Alison, ethics and sustainability are equally important to making profit. So she only sources fair trade organic sugar and cocoa and then works with local Irish products like cow, goat, and even oat milk. I'm so pleased to welcome her into the Good Room to chat all things cocoa. Hi, Alison, and welcome to the Good Room. We're so happy to have you here today. Can you tell us a little bit about your background in chocolate and why ethics in particular are really important to you for this ingredient?
I have been working with chocolate since I was young in Canada. So I was about 12 when I started this business. So it's been a lot of years. So I guess that's led me to learn more and more, like you were saying, delving deeper and deeper the whole time. So because I've been working with chocolate for so long, at the very beginning, you know, I didn't care where it came from. I didn't know where it came from. I didn't think of it as a plant for sure. You know, I totally disconnected it from anything that grew. I never thought that chocolate would be a long-term thing, but as it turned out, this thing that I was working with ended up being a vehicle for me to explore all the things that I was passionate about. So it's almost like a vehicle for me to explore everything I like about and I'm fascinated around sustainability and ethics and consumerism. We didn't think we were living here long-term again, so I wasn't investing in the business as like a long-term, this is my job for life. And only because we lived here year by year and then stayed, it grew with me. So I never had to make a conscious decision like, this is what I'm going to do. It just happened really naturally. So I think that's the only way it really would have worked for me, because I probably would have been a bit too intimidated to start a business that I thought would have to, you know, provide for me for the rest of my life. So it just kind of grew with me. And then when we moved to Clonakilty, there's a sign that says first fair trade town in Ireland. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, interested in that. And we had sustainable Clonakilty at that time. So I kind of joined a couple local groups. So I've been doing work with Fairtrade Group, and through that I went to visit producers in Africa with another friend here, Cindy Kingston, who does fair trade work with me, and it's all volunteer stuff. And then met producers and saw cocoa beans for the first time. That was 2013. So it was from, you know, 1994 to 2013. I was working with chocolate, but I'd never seen a cocoa bean.
It's great that you're taking ethics so seriously, but in reality, I suppose the question might be, how do you make a small business like yours work?
So I was a chocolatier from 12 to 30, and then I went bean to bar 7 years ago. So that obviously takes up a lot more space and a lot more machines. So I converted the back half of the house, and my big struggle as we were converting the back of the house, I found out I was pregnant with my first and only child. So I was like, okay, right. So how's this going to work? My plan was have it in the back for a couple of years and then move it out. But now that like it works so well having a kid and being home, and also the freedom, like one of the things I've always been proud of is like my business is unbreakable. You can't sink me because my overheads are low. And that's the thing. Like I have full control of my business. The way I live the rest of my life is really kind of, you know, we don't need a lot of money. We don't spend a lot. We don't need a lot. So it works really well. But if I were to, you know, take it out of the house, that's a lot to take on. So it's like always the struggle of like, I need to scale up. Oh no, I can't, you know, like the stress of it. And like, I need to find the right people. So we've got a team of four working here now, but all the people who work here only want to work part-time and it works really well for them. And that's a really good model that I really believe in. Like people, one of the guys who works here, he's got like a long-term disability, he's got ME. So it's really important for him to be able to work less hours and like to be able to provide that kind of work for people. Then part of my brain is like, no, this feels right. Like it feels right for me to be able to say, you know, if you can't come in this week, there's no pressure, or, you know, you only want to work 6 hours a week, that's totally fine, and have like a more of a fluid business that can move rather than a really rigid business that has loads of overheads. But it is really hard in this kind of machine that is, you know, consumerism and modernity, where all the pressures are saying like, we'll give you an incentive if you scale, or we'll do this if you scale, or, you know, you need to scale, or how big's your business, or are you busy? Everyone asks, how's the chocolate business? Are you busy? Are you busy? Like, yeah, we're busy, but like, I don't want to be crazy busy.
And where do you sell your chocolate?
So I mainly stock small. I mean, I have I only stock small independent health food and whole food shops, but I go through a distributor, Irish Independent Health Foods, and Ballyvorney, and like local shops. And then a lot of what I do is mail order. So a lot of people buy online. The other struggle that I have is my zero waste passion. So like, when I started out, I was using very little packaging, like a little clear sleeve and a very small paper strip around the middle. But then the further away my chocolate goes, the more packaging it needs, because the minute you break a corner off, nobody wants to buy it. So the packaging, I've got more packaging. All the packaging is biodegradable. It's all compostable. I'm happy with it. But at the same time, it's single-use packaging. I'm not happy with it. So the other kind of thing that I'm passionate about is, because like for me, it's like people want to eat the chocolate, and my chocolate is all about the ingredients, and it's like the coconut sugar, and everything is organic. All the cocoa is organic fair trade, sugar is organic fair trade, and then I have Irish milk, goat's milk, and so it's all about kind of the alternatives and stuff. So for me to be putting it into all that packaging, if you just want to eat it, you know, let me offer it to you with less packaging. So online, I do bear bar bundles. So you can buy like a bundle of bars just wrapped in wax paper. So it's much cheaper. And then I also sell my couverture. So it's like what I do in the stone grinder. We grind the nibs with the coconut sugar for 3 days, pour that into slabs, and then we break it up. And you can buy that by the kilo or by the 200 grams or whatever. So it's much. And when it's called cooking chocolate, there's no VAT. So you're saving VAT. It's a lot less processing, you know, there's less packaging. So I can, because, you know, another part of this passion is making good food accessible to people, because the minute you put it into, you know, you make it and then you have your chocolate, but you have chocolate and then you take the chocolate and you temper it and then you mold it and then you wrap it and then you package it and then, you know, you're shipping it and then you're giving it to a shop and then they put their markup on and then you give it to, and then the VAT man takes the markup. So something that I might get, you know, €2 for is €4.75 in the shop. So it's a huge difference for people and accessibility. And if somebody, like I had people at markets buying my chocolate being like, oh, I'd love to buy this and make cookies with it. I was like, what? No, like all that packaging, like just buy a slab. And they're, oh, right. Okay. So I've done a lot more of that, and I'm in a few refill shops. And most of my web orders now are not for packaged chocolate bars. Most of my web orders are for either I do the tea, which is from the skins of the beans, or the broken shards, or the unwrapped bars, or the things that I don't do in shops.
So when it comes to making an ethical decision about something, if you're going into the shop and you're trying to choose what to buy from an ethical perspective, do you think it's up to the consumer to be able to make those decisions on their own, or do you think that's more of a business decision that needs to be made at a business level?
There's a whole kind of thing that people say, like, oh, as a consumer, you know, you consumers have the power, and consumers in the grocery store, your shopping cart and your power. But actually, I think that's way too complicated for people. Like, that's actually impossible. That's way too many decisions to put on people. I really think it comes down to the companies, and the companies need to be held accountable. And I need to feel good about how I make my living. And if I'm making a living off the back of slaves, and children who are being kidnapped in West Africa, that's not going to sit well with me. But if I put the blinders on and don't want to think about it, that's different, you know? And the good thing about small business is when you buy something, you're buying it off the person who knows about the product chain. So I, you know, I would be lying to you. Whereas in a big company, you could have someone in marketing and someone in supply, and they might not speak. So you could be completely ignorant in the marketing department of what's going on in the supply chain. And that's dangerous. I think that's what's dangerous with big business. You can see already how easy it is to be like, oh, well, that's a little bit cheaper, you know, maybe I'll get that. it's impossible for a chocolate bar to be that cheap. And when you put my chocolate bar next to a cheap chocolate bar, people think, oh, well, that's because, you know, you're overpricing. But it's actually, that's the cost. Yeah, absolutely. If I was a much bigger business, I could get the price down with scalability. Absolutely. It could go down a little bit. But there's no way it's ever going down to 90 cents a bar.
What makes cocoa so special? And maybe how is it grown traditionally? How would it grow in its natural state?
In their natural environment, cocoa pods are shade grown. So they're like an understory tree. They're quite a short tree. And they grow generally under like amazing hardwoods, like ebony and mahogany, like all the big, beautiful trees in a small scale farm. So in fair trade, basically links together loads of small farms. They're usually like up to 4 hectares. So they're not very big, even smaller 1 hectare farms. And they're generally owned by women. There's 2 harvests a year. And so they're doing other things in between. They're planting, there's pineapples planted around and other things. And it's just, there's like, you basically go from 40 degree heat into this forest that's like a nice like 28 degrees heat. It's just like immediately lovely. And but they're, you know, they're opening them all up with machetes. It's, you have to take it off the tree with the special hook that I have. And if you don't take it off the tree properly, it won't fruit again. So it fruits from the exact same spot every time. So you can't, like, not like an apple tree, you can't shake them and gather them or anything. They have to be, each one has to be hand harvested, then each one has to be broken open, and they have to be scooped out. The inside is like this white pulp with all the, with the beans inside that's piled underneath banana leaves, and that ferments for like 4 or 5 days, and then they sun dry it for another 3 to 4 days. So it's just, it's heavy. Everything about it is heavy and labor intensive. It's, and it's like very far from like this fine chocolate kind of idea that we have in our heads. It's a sacred thing. Like, it is a sacred, very difficult to grow, hard to harvest. Like, everything about it is not, it's not easy and takes loads of effort. Like, between a coffee roaster and a bean to bar chocolate maker, there's like a million steps in making the chocolate instead of just roasting and grinding your beans at the spot. You know, we're roasting, we're cracking, we're winnowing, we're grinding for 3 days, we have to age the chocolate, we're tempering, then we're packaging. There's so many steps involved. There's no way that you can do that on, you know, without it having a cost.
So you said you went bean to bar several years ago after working with chocolate for many, many years of your life. What's the difference between working from bean to bar and what you were doing previously, which would be working with, I'm assuming, couverture? Like, a chocolatier, you generally get in the chocolate that's already been made into what we call couverture. And then you take that couverture and you turn it into chocolate creations. Bean to bar, you're taking the raw beans. And so I guess, what was the transition like for you from that?
Like, I think that's, I kind of liken that to carpentry. Like, when you have, you know, you go to the lumberyard, you buy your wood, and then you make your planter. And that's, obviously, that's fantastic. But then the bean to bar is, you're going into the forest and you're getting your felling, or, you know, you're doing more of, you're preparing the wood to be made. But the reason I think that's shifted is because, as chocolatiers, like, you could ship the chips, you know, before, but you weren't, before the plastic revolution, you couldn't ship a hollow Easter bunny. So it was the job of the local chocolatier to make the nice shapes. But now, because of plastic, basically, you can ship all the chocolate products all over the world. So the role of the chocolatier is diminished. And then, well, during that time, the ethics of the ingredients have obviously changed a lot. And we now know a lot about what's happening. So then the bean to bar chocolate makers have come out of that going like, no, now we're interested in ingredients. We're still interested maybe a little bit in shape, but we're more interested in ingredients. And we want the freedom to control everything that goes into our chocolate rather than buying something in that already has its milk and sugar and its lecithin or whatever else you have in it.
Why is fair trade in particular so important to you?
Fair trade is kind of a stopgap measure for certain parts of the world. It's very important in West Africa, incredibly important. And that's because of the way that the Ghana Cocoa Board, the Ghana ports run the ports. And it's like $4,500 for you to get a port license to be able to sell. So you have to be able to fill a container. So because of those laws, it's catered to the Ghana Cocoa Board, which is the big government controlled cocoa board. They have the ability to kind of control all the farmers, because the farmers can't get to market without somebody having access to the port. So that's why fair trade came in. 70% of the world's chocolate still comes, cocoa still comes from West Africa. So like when we talk about like, you know, when you talk about chocolate, a lot of people are like, oh, it's that South American chocolate now. And like, there's a lot more chocolate coming from there. Absolutely not. There isn't. That's just the high end ethically traded chocolate.
And so fair trade is helping these farmers gain access to the port, perhaps by working in cooperatives together and finding the funds to be able to ship their cocoa in a different way. And so who do you source your cocoa from?
I was buying through Kwapa Cocoa, which is a fair trade cooperative. Now I'm buying through the Abocfa, so it's A-B-O-C-F-A cooperative. And they're kind of a newer, they're organic and fair trade in Ghana. So they're like the forerunners of what could happen. They're big enough now that they can fill their own containers. And that's the main thing. You have to be able to kind of work as a unit. So like that's all I do, is I have to kind of pre-order my beans. I only use maybe 2 tons of cocoa a year, which is very small scale for bean to bar. And they go to the Hook of Holland. So they get all bagged up. Obviously, they go to the Hook of Holland, where they get all the air sucked out of them and they get dropped really low in temperature. And so that kind of sterilizes them, make sure there's no creepy crawlers or anything coming across. And then they come here, but they're just stacked. 8 bags is a half a ton onto a pallet and they get dropped off here. So they're just raw cocoa beans.
We know fair trade, it has its problems. It's not a perfect way of doing trade and economics either. But so why do you think it's so important to continue on with it?
We have to start somewhere. And it's a very good starting point. I mean, like the people, when I met people there, they like the change that fair trade makes from non-fair trade to conventional to fair trade is humongous. And that's why I support it. Because the other thing I was going to say, like, I also say like direct trade, South America, farmers have different access to market. They're able to sell more directly. Absolutely, if you have a relationship, you can find really ethical cocoa. Also, like there isn't as much traceability, but also there isn't this big, like kind of massive cocoa board that's pushing prices down. The West African industry was built up around slaves, so that industry is the most messed up. So absolutely direct trade and other countries, Hawaiian chocolate, you know, Vietnamese chocolate, there's all these amazing places where you can get cocoa from. But I'm interested in the place where kind of really like wealthy white people did the most damage and made the most profit off of. So I'm interested in being in that space and trying to at least put my small amount of business towards making it better. And I've kind of always said I want my business to seem bigger than it is. So like I'm more interested in the advocacy. I'm interested in doing courses and workshops and talking to people about it and kind of just so that people at least know, you know, you have to know what you're buying. And still, like if there's a boxes of quality streets, you know, there doesn't mean you don't have to have a chocolate, but just sometimes it's not to make people feel guilty, but it's meant to, I think, just allow people to think this isn't a food that came from nowhere. Like, you know, you have to know that it came from somewhere, and like everything else, it's about trying your best. And I struggle because I think, like, you know, if I buy stuff with plastic, I give myself a hard time, but it's still hard to avoid it, but still we can try to buy less. So instead of buying 8 Easter eggs, you know, for your kids, you can buy 1 or 2. Kids don't need that much chocolate. They don't even want it. Like they get sick of it.
What does it take for a small business like yourself to become fair trade certified? And is there a lot of paperwork? What are some of the things that you have to do to be certified fair trade?
If we have to own our decisions, I wish that there was rules about, you know, saying like, this is not fair trade on the packaging. That would be amazing. But like for me to be fair trade, I have to pay fees and, you know, get inspected and it's all this hassle and I'm a small business. I don't like paperwork. And then for me to, I was going to do my organic thing in January this year, but it's another 500 euros. It's more paperwork. Like I have the ingredients. That's what's the most important to me. And I do know communicating to customers is important, but the paperwork is just like, I don't want to do more paperwork. Doing the right thing causes so much more paperwork and like fees. Whereas, and then you have to like all the rules around the packaging, the design and where the logo has to go and where it has to fit and the language you're allowed to use. And I don't want to be wasting packaging that I've already printed. I'm going to use that packaging.
You say fair trade works really well regionally, depending on the place and the situation, it can work really well in that it's very important for West Africa. So are there any current issues with fair trade in West Africa that still need addressing?
So that's only like, I think it's like 8-20% of all of the cocoa in West Africa is grown in a fair trade way, and they can't even sell that much. There isn't enough, they don't have enough buyers for all the fair trade that they produce. Because obviously more and more farmers want to sign up for fair trade, but if you don't have the people who are going to buy it, so there's an oversupply of fair trade chocolate, and then the fair trade chocolate ends up getting sold as conventional chocolate at a reduced price, which affects all the fair trade farmers. Just to say on that, like, in one thing that people don't realize is that's very different about fair trade. There's two things. One is that it's the only certification system that is independently run and audited. So it's not attached to any corporation. And that is huge. So it's not owned by anyone. And then the other thing is that the fair trade premium goes to, like, basically the town elders. It doesn't necessarily go to cocoa growers. It goes to an elected representative in the town. And that's the extra money. So the farmers get paid a living wage. And then on top of that, there's money that's given basically to the town or the district for development. And they can spend that however they want. And there's usually, like, it's basically kind of like a council of elders that get together and they're like, what do we need? We need sanitation. We need, that's where all that kind of the schools or the new industries. And you could see when we went to visit different communities, the longer they'd been fair trade, the more things they'd had set up. And now they're starting to invest in like batik or new plants. Or so once you've got your sanitation done, once you've got your schools kind of done and your community center, then the premium can start. The town, you could see the once it running water, like it starts at the basics, and then they start spending all the money on all these amazing projects around the town that benefit everyone. And that's huge. No other certification project does that.
And I suppose, like you mentioned to me before, that a good way to look at your chocolate bar and find out whether or not it's made with ethical cocoa is the traceability or lack thereof. So if you're looking at a chocolate bar and there's no actual traceability on it, there's no fair trade certification on it, it doesn't tell you where the cocoa is coming from, then you said it yourself to me previously, it's that's probably dodgy chocolate. So you can assume that that is probably coming from West Africa, and it's probably coming from chocolate that's not being regulated very well. So thank you for talking us through that. I guess my last question for you is, you know, you're like myself, you're coming from Canada to Ireland, you've been here for many years now. Are you happy here, and do you enjoy doing business in Ireland?
Yeah, I love it here because it's a real, like, when I don't think I'd be doing this anywhere else. Because when I was in Canada, like, people, what are you doing? Are you making chocolate? How many bars do you make? How much do you charge for a bar? How much is your profit for a bar? And it's just like, okay, so you want to know how much I make? Is that's like, basically here, they're like, oh, you're doing chocolate? They really are encouraging, like, straight away, first and foremost, you're doing something awesome. Like, doesn't matter what you're doing. I love to hear that people are doing things. That's just seems to be the thing here. You're doing something different and interesting. Welcome. And that's what I think small business has the potential to do too. Like that's why small business is so great. Like we run a bicycle festival here. We do, you know, small businesses are run by people, and people live in communities. And the more the people are in the communities, the more they want to invest in the communities. But if I commute to do a job, I'm not going to be as invested in my community. But if I'm here, you know, buying all my supplies locally, as like, obviously not my chocolate, but my invoice books and my envelopes and everything. If I'm in and out of all the shops, they know me, I know them, I want the best for them, they want the best for me. It's a different way of living. It's lovely.
Well, folks, that's all for our April edition of The Good Room. I have to thank all of my interviewees for sharing their wisdom and their stories. I also want to thank the amazing production team here at Irish Country Living and the Irish Farmers Journal, and in particular, my friend and colleague, Claire Nash, for always making me sound so good. Stay tuned for next month's edition, where we discuss how we can create and sustain food secure communities. Until then, it's time to close up the Good Room for another few weeks. No one allowed in. Gotta keep the place looking nice.